This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After a week of frantic detective work, the investigation continues into the life and death of the nation's first documented victim of mad cow disease. We still don't know exactly how old she was. Her Canadian birth has yet to be absolutely confirmed. And as yet, we don't know if there are other infected cattle in the nation's herds. While American and Canadian officials race to answer these questions, officials in more than 20 countries around the world continue to follow the mystery from behind precautionary trade barriers. Later this hour, we'll look at what the just-announced ban on ephedra means for the dietary supplement industry, but first, the science and public policy of mad cow disease. If you have questions about downed cows, the risk to humans, inspections in the meat industry, or the economic effects of mad cow, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. We'd especially like to hear from people who work in the cattle industry. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us for most of this hour in Studio 3A is Dr. Richard Johnson, professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins University and advisor to the National Institutes of Health on this class of diseases. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, Neil.
The government has issued a recall for beef in 8 western states. In Guam, what precisely are they worried about?
They're worried about the potential, although unlikely, contamination of this meat with the prions or the infectious agents of this disease.
And they would be, we were told, not in the muscle meat, the steaks and chops, but in the brain and the spinal cord.
Well, to be perfectly clear, there's a very large amount of them in the brain and spinal cord. There is a small amount present in lymph nodes, bone marrow, ileum, and there is an argument about whether it's present in meat. Now, the accepted experiments have been those in which the muscle meat, the kind of meat we eat as steak, has been injected intracerebrally into other cows, and they have not gotten sick. So that would seem to give it a very clear-cut answer that there's no infection there. However, last week, a Swiss group, a very good laboratory in Zurich, reported that they had found infectivity in the muscles of humans with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So they'd previously been reported in mice by Stan Prusner. So that there have been several reports of muscle being involved, not in cows. So it's probably not, but we can't, you know, don't bet the bank on it.
Now, what happened to the then really infectious parts of the cow, the brain and the spinal cord?
That's exactly what I'd like to know. The report that I saw from the people from the Department of Agriculture was the brain and spinal cord had not entered the food chain, but had been rendered. Rendering, of course, is an indirect entry into the food chain because rendered material is both used in human material such as cosmetics and soap, lard. But it's also used as animal, in a very large way, as animal food, so it returns to animal feed.
Doesn't rendering suggest the idea that this is heated? Wouldn't that kill the prions?
It lowers the titer, but it does not kill it. And the titer and brain, the level of infectivity, the level of infectivity is so high in the brain and spinal cord that it might reduce it 10, even 100-fold. But it would still be lots of infectious material.
And so the infected parts of the cow could pose a risk even after rendering?
Oh, yes, indeed. Indeed, the entire epidemic in England, the huge epidemic that they had there of mad cow disease, was due to the feeding of rendered beef parts back to beef. And therefore, they amplified the epidemic, and hundreds of thousands of cows died.
But is there any evidence of infected products of rendering infecting humans?
We don't know. Not direct evidence. There have been 143 people in England now and then a few on the continent who developed a variant of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is the agent, which appears to be the same agent as that one that causes mad cow. The assumption has been that it's been eating meat that has been contaminated with brain and spinal cord. But we don't know that for certain. It could be the exposure to fertilizers, which are made from bone meal in the rendering process. It could be from other products coming from the rendering process, or it could be from the consumption, as we normally assume, of bone meal, of meat.
Now, tell us a little bit about this disease, BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, if I think I got that
That's
right.
That's exactly right.
Now, this isn't your standard virus, is it?
Oh, no, this is not a virus, from all we know. In its very bizarre way, it doesn't appear to have a nucleic acid, which is, of course, the very essence of life. And I suppose one could say, are these live or not live? And the answer would be no one really knows. They're misfolded proteins, so that you have a normal shape of a protein called the prion protein that somehow gets changed to an isoform or bad folding. That bad folded protein in some way induces a cascade of misfolding. And this becomes the buildup of this transmissible agent, and it happens primarily in brain and spinal cord.
Let's take some phone calls. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Dr. Richard Johnson of the Johns Hopkins University. And let's begin with Ed, who's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. I just had there were two parts to my question, really. The first one was that I'd heard in the British scientific press, the popular scientific press, that there are a couple of instances of vertical transmission from the mother to a calf. Are you aware of any of those?
Yes, I'm aware of that. I can hear from your accent that you're from Britain.
Yes.
And, yes, that became quite an issue several years ago when there was suspicion that there may have been some transmissions that were vertical. That is, animals developed a disease whose maternal ancestor had also had the disease.
Yeah.
And therefore, when you had probably over 1 million cows with the disease, at least 900,000, it would disappear within that. I mean, this could be coincidence, because the coincidence would be quite high. The likelihood of coincidence would be so high. So that was never definitely answered, whether the vertical transmission occurred.
Okay.
It gives us an option with this one mad cow now.
The new one in Washington.
The one in Washington that has several living children, calves, now cows, that those can be examined and would certainly give evidence whether vertical transmission occurs.
Well, actually, and there was a second part to my question. I worked, my very first job was in a slaughterhouse in Britain, and during the processing of a cow carcass, they basically saw the carcass down the middle, and which saws straight through the spinal cord. And although I accept from my understanding that the prions cannot get into that aren't present in the muscle meat, during that process, you basically saw straight through the spinal cord and the rest of the meat in the cow, and it spreads that material.
Absolutely correct.
And is that the current case in the processing of carcasses in America?
No, the recommended processing is to not cut through the spinal cord and splatter nervous system tissue onto the meat. How well that's enforced is another problem. We can ask Linda Detweiler when she gets on the show. She'll know that.
And that'll be in a few minutes.
In a few minutes. But the fact is that is it's recommended that not happen. Now, it could have been that these cases that have occurred in England were back in a time when there was a lot of contamination. It could have been a time when brains and spinal cord were put into boneless meats of various sorts, sausages and so forth. Now, there are strict recommendations as to how to do the harvesting, but we, again, don't know how carefully they're followed.
Obviously, the deaths in Britain and the devastating effects on the British cattle industry are sobering reminders of what can happen with BSE, though.
Well, it's astonishing when you look at the whole of Europe. I mean, it almost broke up the European Union. It was one of the major factors in the falling of the party politics in England, etc.
Ed, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Greg, and Greg is with us from Kaiser, is that right, Oregon?
Kaiser, excuse me. Yeah, it's a suburb of Salem.
Okay.
Well, I'm someone who ate some of the meat that was withdrawn. I got it at my local Albertsons supermarket. It was ground beef dated December 18. So you can sort of follow along with me and see what happens over the next 3 or 4 years. But my question is this: why does the federal government allow diseased animals to be processed into the food chain? When a cow is sick at a dairy, apparently it's sent off to slaughter.
These are the so-called downed cows.
Downer cows.
Yes. Why in the name of God are they feeding us diseased animals?
Because, see if I can put this somewhat delicately, there have been, I think, two or three times this has been brought up as in regulations which have been turned down by our Congress, mainly from legislators from beef-raising states. So you might check how your local congressman voted on that issue.
Well, I've written them letters.
You're obviously very personally concerned with this, Greg.
Well, some people may think I'm funny as it is, but if I get funnier over the years, we may know the reason.
Well, we can only wish you good luck and right. Remind you that the odds are pretty good.
The odds are very good. You've got to remember that of the 50 plus million people in England who ate beef, which was with enormous amounts of infectivity. They ate 900,000 infected animals that were actually, in retrospect, were probably served as meat. 900,000. And that of those 55 million people, 143 have gotten sick.
Well, here's an email.
So that gives you the odds.
Email from Kathy in Albany, California. Why are persons who lived in England nearly 20 years ago for 6 or more months prohibited from donating blood if it is so difficult to get CJD from diseased animals? It seems the blood supply is being overly protected if the risk is as low as we're being told.
Yes, I'd agree with that. I think the blood supply has been overprotected. It was done on a decision based on being excessively conservative. The theoretical risk of the variant of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease being transmitted by blood was clearly there, and it was decided on a split vote by the advisory committee, actually, that handled this, to exclude blood from people who had been 6 months or more in England between 1980 and 1996. That was the first rule. Now, 2 weeks ago, you may have missed it in the news, but there was a probable transmission in England, or a possible transmission in England. And it may, in retrospect, make that rule look very wise indeed. There have been 15 people in England who have received blood from one of those 143 who donated before they came down with disease. And those 15 people are being followed. One of them, last year, came down with and died from the variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Now, that may be coincidence, but when you consider the numbers, it's rather staggering to realize that with the small numbers, that's a very large percentage, 1 out of 15.
Here's another email question. From Diane in, I'm not sure where Diane is from. Anyway, is it a health risk to drink milk from a diseased cow?
Not that we know of at all. And that was looked at very carefully in England, where there was great concern about milk and cheese products early in the epidemic. And both transmission studies and all the studies of exposure show no contamination of milk.
And that's significant in this case. The cow involved was a dairy cow.
Well, most of the cows who've had clinical mad cow disease have been dairy cows, because most other cows are eaten before they get to be 4 years of age. The average incubation period in a cow is 4 years or more. And therefore, most cattle are slaughtered prior to that time. It is mainly the dairy cows and the breeding bulls that are kept alive for that long time.
We're talking about the discovery of mad cow disease in Washington State last week and how it's affecting the cattle industry and meat eaters in the U.S. We'll take more of your calls after a break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, TOTN@NPR.org. And Linda Detweiler will join us, the adjunct assistant professor at the University of Maryland, who recently retired as the USDA's top veterinarian. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the first case of mad cow disease in the U.S. and its regulatory implications for the meat industry and safety for the American public. We want to hear from you. If you have questions about how the cattle industry is regulated, or if you're involved in the industry, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. With us here in Studio 3A is Dr. Richard Johnson of Johns Hopkins University. And joining us now from her home in New Jersey is Linda Detweiler, who recently retired as the U.S. Department of Agriculture's top veterinarian on mad cow disease and now an assistant professor at the University of Maryland. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. Let me just make one correction.
Oh, I'm sorry?
Thank you, flattering title, but I was a senior staff veterinarian and a very technical versus top veterinarians.
Oh, well, all right. But you helped write the USDA regulations on mad cow disease, did you not?
I was involved in assisting with policy and setting up surveillance, yes.
I know Linda very well, and Linda knows a lot about mad cow disease.
Okay, well, Linda. That's why she's on the program. And Linda, do you think that this discovery was inevitable?
I think after we looked at the Harvard risk assessment and did some other assessments on there, it allowed the possibility. I think that in looking back, and we had imported some cattle from the United Kingdom back in the 1980s, many before the fact that we knew BSE existed in the world, and given that some of those had already gone into the U.S. and the Canadian production system, it was as it was characterized in the risk assessments, unlikely but could not fully be excluded, and I think that's important. And I think the USDA, we knew that there was a possibility that this could happen.
Now, the best guess right now is that this is sort of a hangover case, the one cow that may have eaten contaminated feed before the regulations took effect, and the disease only presented itself 4 years later. But do you think that we're going to discover more cases if we do a thorough investigation of the nation's herd?
Well, I think that's exactly correct, is that this case, if she was indeed born in April of 1997, could have been exposed to feed prior to the ban. I think that we do have to leave the possibility that there will be additional cases, just the way the disease, it's through a feeding system. And usually you have multiple animals exposed to the same feed. Now, I do want to point out, though, it's not a highly contagious disease. It doesn't spread from cow to cow. And even within a cattle herd, there must be something in a cow that protects, or the way the cows get the disease. But even in England, when they had very heavily infectious doses going into the feed, still maybe 1, 2, 3 cattle got it. Wouldn't be like the entire herd getting the disease. And that mechanism we don't understand.
Let's get a caller involved. This is Jim, who's with us from Baton Rouge.
Yes, sir. I'm kind of disgusted with the cattle industry that they allowed their lobbyists to put their markets in the jeopardy that they are now. They actively lobbied against and allowed allowed Congress to vote against the stopping of downer cows getting into the food chain. They're sending, instead of self-regulating, they have a possibility that something, a cow might have mad cow disease, and they still send the spinal column and brains to rendering rather than hold it. It was a matter of complete and utter greed, ruling the day, and it's coming back to bite them in the nether region.
Would you agree, Linda Detweiler?
I usually don't like to make opinions on actions of folks, but other than to say that I couldn't agree more that now is the time that the government and the industry have to look at additional safeguards that must be put in place. I think I really couldn't say that strongly enough.
Dr. Johnson, what do you think, that the industry was short-sighted in working to defeat regulations that might have caught this, prevented this from getting into the food chain?
Yes, I think that's quite true.
Jim, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to, this is Rebecca, and Rebecca's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, the gentleman in from Denver talked about the quality control process or lack thereof in the slaughterhouses, so I won't go to that issue. But when I came on, I heard Dr. Johnson talking about the fact that the cattle in England were fed rendered products and still became ill, and I don't hear anything about a recall of the product that went to the rendering facilities. So what about our pets?
Is this going into pet food, do you think, Dr. Johnson?
Well, that is a source of pet food, is the rendering companies. Where the I haven't seen any, maybe Linda knows, but I haven't seen any data of where the central nervous system of this animal went for rendering and what products that rendering company sells to.
It was my understanding that FDA announced that they had the rendering under a hold order, all the material.
So it's
good.
I mean, eventually it did go to rendering. I mean, that part they didn't stop, but they had the material that it was incorporated into under a hold order.
But doesn't this speak to the necessity for a more comprehensive tracking system to keep an idea of where all of this material is as it moves through the various food chains and also in terms of the rendered products and into other kinds of products?
Oh, I think it speaks even more than the necessity of a tracking system. I think it speaks to the necessity of looking at additional safeguards, for example, of the prohibiting brain and spinal cord to not be fed, period, for human or animal consumption.
To any animal.
To any animal.
Or people.
Right.
There are two sources, interestingly enough, Neil, in which people are fed. One is that you can go out and buy brains and spinal cord if you so desire it. I mean, it's some ethnic groups.
Calves' brains are a delicacy in some places.
I grew up in a family, a Swedish family, where calves' brains were a delicacy with scrambled eggs in the morning. On the other hand, it's also included in health foods. A number of the health foods which are exempt from FDA controls approval do have, if you look on the labels, if they're labeled correctly, you'll see that it may say raw desiccated brain and spinal cord on the label.
And that would be potentially at least infectious.
It's not even regulated what country it comes from, as far as I know.
What types of products would those be in?
What types of supplements?
Things that make you manly.
Oh, okay.
Rebecca,
it's like rhinoceros horn. It's this mythological idea that if you eat brains of a bull, you'll get strong.
Organic food stores were the refuge.
Oh no, this isn't your vitamin shop. This is your health foods.
Okay.
I mean the health additives.
The supplements.
The same stuff that Ephedra's in, which I guess you're taking up later.
We'll talk about Ephedra later in the program. Rebecca, I think you're safe, and thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see if we can get another caller in with Linda Detweiler. Natalia joins us from Methuen, Massachusetts.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I heard yesterday on NPR that cow parts are no longer fed back to them, but they are fed to chickens and pigs. And their parts, after slaughter, are then fed back to the cows in their feed. So my question is, then when we eat the cows, are we now incurring a once-removed risk?
Linda Detweiler?
Yeah, that actually is a theory that really needs to be even explored more. The experiments that are done thus far, and that's what I'll tell you, they're done thus far, doesn't mean that there shouldn't be more work done. In Britain, they took BSE-infected brain, they fed it to pigs and they fed it to chickens. This is just raw brain, so the most highly infectious material.
Mm-hmm.
They let the animals live for long periods of time, we're talking years, and then at the end of the lifetime, they euthanized the animal and they looked for evidence of disease. They did not find any. They then said, well, maybe the animal just harbored the disease. So they said, let's look to see if it was in certain tissues where you might expect it.
Mm-hmm.
So they took brain then from those pigs and those chickens that didn't get sick or had no other evidence and inoculated into susceptible mice. And thus far, there's been no result or infectivity or passing the disease onto the mice, which would suggest that the risk is very remote that this would happen. But given that you can't say that it's totally absent, that's why I really support remove the risk tissue, so the brain and spinal cord from cattle out of rations for all animals, because then you're going to remove infectivity out of the animal feed cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And not humans. I don't mean to say don't remove it from humans, but I'm talking this animal feed cycle.
Right. Then could I follow up on the statement that someone made about mice? And you've just made, that they also are susceptible to this disease. So if one has experienced, as we did here a few years ago, an epidemic of mice, is there then risk that, can it be transmitted simply by having had the mice all over the place?
You mean mice, M-I-C-E, right?
M-I-C-E, right.
Yeah, then this would be inoculating into their brains.
Oh, okay.
They use them as an experiment. I'm sorry. They use mice as an experimental animal. because it doesn't take them as long to get sick.
Right.
If you did the experiment in the natural host, you have to keep cattle alive 8 years. So this is one way, if you, you have a type of mouse experiment, you know, lab mouse that you know will get sick within like 2 years, you use those to increase your, you know, cut down your time and increase the number of animals you can inject to see if there's disease there.
Right.
Thanks for the question, Natalia.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let me also ask, there are other related diseases that have been of concern before the USDA a couple of years ago. The concern was about scrapies in sheep. Is that a related illness?
It is a related illness. It's in the same family, the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. It's a disease that's been known in the world for 250 years. And to all the best evidence, the one difference with scraping sheep, and there are differences between the diseases, is that with all these years and experience and epidemiologic evidence, it does not appear to cause any disease in humans.
Okay.
But yet it does spread, though, from sheep to sheep. So there are different characteristics, although it's in the same family.
Yeah, it's interesting that that scrapie spreads from sheep to sheep in the field, whereas there's no evidence of BSE, or bovine spongiform encephalopathy, mad cow disease, spreading cow to cow in the field. That seems to be entirely spread by feeding. So you've got this very similar disease in two different species, but with different modes of spread.
And the other thing about, you say it's, aren't there spontaneous cases or unknown origin cases of BSE in cows?
Well, that's argued in the literature going back several centuries. Also, there's a report in the French literature several hundred years ago of scrapie in a cow, which may have been nothing at all. I mean, who knows? There have been other hints that there may be a spontaneous disease, and I think one of the interesting things that's being looked at right now is the molecular detail, as much as can be done, with this isolate in Washington. Was that a case related to the BSE epidemic in England with feeding, or was that a spontaneous case? Is there a low spontaneous rate of this disease in cattle? We don't know that.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Jack, who's with us from Baltimore.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon.
If you and Dr. Johnson and Ms. Detweiler would indulge me for one moment, I wonder why a single head of cattle in a huge industry with a brain disease is considered so out of the ordinary. Humans have mental illness not from people eating feed made from humans. I mean, we are dealing with a food source that is an organism. Thank goodness there isn't mad tofu disease. That's my point. Thank you very much.
Okay, Jack, bye. Thanks. Do you care to answer that, Dr. Johnson?
Yes, there is in humans a disease called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, the sporadic form of it, the kind we have in this country and all over the world, that occurs at a rate of 1 per million population per year, 1 in a million per year, about 250 cases a year in the United States. It's a rare disease, but it occurs every year. It occurs in every season of the year. It occurs with no known exposures of any sort. Even being married to somebody for 40 years who develops this disease doesn't increase your risk. So this is thought to be a spontaneous origin of this disease. And that's why some of us who deal in human medicine think that there's no reason spontaneous disease shouldn't happen in a cow.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of this, and there's a very bizarre and rather morbid twist to this, and that is that in the 1960s, a disease broke out on a South Pacific island, which they called Kuru, which was related to the cannibalism, family cannibalism, ritual cannibalism. They consumed their loved ones to give them immortality. And that there was an epidemic of a disease they called Kuru, which is probably a very similar, if not the same disease, originating from food, much as the mad cow disease epidemic did. So there are parallels in human disease, strange as they may be. Now, when the cannibalism was stopped in New Guinea in 1959, there were no cases after that. I mean, it just disappeared. It has disappeared since, but it has disappeared with an incubation period of 4 to 40 years.
We're speaking with Dr. Richard Johnson and Linda Detweiler about mad cow disease. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And this is an email question from Mimi. Please discuss if the way halal and kosher cattle are raised is different from the way most other cattle is raised, and what about slaughtering methods? Linda Detweiler?
To be honest, I'm not sure how they're raised, if there's different. I've heard that, you know, there might be different feeding practices for halal. I don't know if there's different feeding practices for kosher. I'm sorry, that's not my expertise. The slaughtering practice, there may be one instance, but it's no longer used in the United States, where there was a pneumatic stunner right before slaughter, and that did cause parts of the brain emboli, to go through the circulatory system, through the blood vessels, and lodge in certain tissues. Now, that's no longer used in the United States, but that would be one difference where the halal and kosher kill would not have that problem, if in other countries that's used. I would like to also add one thing with Dr. Johnson's thing about theory about kuru, because I think it's important for BSE in the world. Much like kuru was thought to be spread through a ritualistic eating, etc., BSE, because it's not a contagious disease, that there's a possibility in the world, if the only way to transmit is through the feed, and the countries of the world have feed bans that stop the spread, there may be a day in the world where we no longer see the disease. And that's true for the United States.
As we, well, let's get another caller in. This is David, who's with us from Cooksbury, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering why the United States inspects such a small number of cows in comparison to other countries like Japan. It seems that if experts from both countries were trying to solve the same problem, they would come up with numbers that are relatively close. So why is the United States so short?
Dr. Johnson, you want to take that? And we have about a minute left.
I think Linda can better answer that,
all
actually.
Right.
Linda?
Okay. I think if you looked at Japan before they had their first case, you'd see more of a surveillance system that was on the lines of the United States prior to this case. I think if you looked in most countries of the world, that's what you would find. Countries do surveillance, or one does surveillance for a couple of reasons. You look to see if you don't know if you have a disease in a population, you look for that way. You also use surveillance to see if your prevention programs are working, or if you have the disease, if your control and eradication efforts are working. So I think there's different motivations for surveillance. And prior to the first case, what you're doing is trying to find the disease. And given limited resources, most countries have used statistical approaches, and that's exactly what the U.S. did. They took the population, which is most at risk, the downer population and the neurologically ill. They set a target and statistically found the number that would give it a rate of 1 per million. So we looked at the down population. It was estimated.
I'm afraid we're just running out of time. We're just going to have to leave it there. But we appreciate your time, Linda Detweiler. Linda Detweiler recently retired from her job as one of the USDA's top veterinarians. She reached her at her home in New Jersey. And Dr. Johnson, thank you for being with us. Dr. Richard Johnson of the Johns Hopkins University. When we come back from a break, ephedra banned today. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. And before we leave the subject of mad cow disease altogether, Dr. Richard Johnson wanted to let you know that the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences has just published a report called Advancing Prion Science. It's not available in print yet, but if you'd like to take a look at it, you can go to their website at www.nap.edu and go to Prion, P-R-I-O-N.